KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from San Leandro.
I'm living in Richmond.
Vallejo.
San Jose.
Oakland.
West Oakland. In the bottom of 12th Street.
Coming up, we'll hear from young filmmakers on climate change, their future, and film.
There's a good chance that we will live worse lives than the generations before us. And we, of course, think it's extremely unfair because we weren't responsible for the decisions that have impacted our climate.
Then we'll head to a neighborhood known as San Francisco's Garden District.
There's a whole block of greenhouses, and they used to grow roses and all different kinds of flowers that supplied San Francisco and Central California.
And a conversation with one of the dancers from Hamilton.
I'm the ballet guy amongst my b-boy friends, you know, so we'd still practice and do hip-hop. I was straddling two worlds, which is really funny.
Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. Last Friday, millions of young people across the world walked out of class and took to the streets in what some are calling the largest climate protest in world history. In San Francisco, they gathered at Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi's office and flooded down Market Street, chanting, banging drums, and calling for action. And young people are leading the charge in other ways, too. High schoolers Jeffrey Chen and Alexis Bugs Hodgson believe film is one of the best ways to get environmental messages across. And they both are participating in this year's San Francisco Green Film Festival. Alexis's short film won the 2019 Youth Filmmaker Award, and Jeffrey is moderating a Youth Voices panel. They joined KALW's Angela Johnston in studio.
Alexis, tell me a little bit about your film.
My film, it's about basically there's a girl and she wakes up and she goes to turn on the radio and all that she's hearing is about the climate crisis. And no matter where, what channel she switches to, it's always about the climate crisis.
The Arctic ice levels were at its third lowest.
Millions of people are dying every year from air pollution.
And when she turns on the TV, all the regular shows are canceled, and the only one that pops up is about the climate crisis, and it kind of just goes into a sequence explaining how the climate crisis is affecting the air quality and how it's affecting the earth.
Part of that, especially turning on the radio and hearing about climate change on the news, is quite real. It's not this imagined future.
Yeah.
And why did you decide to make it? What inspired you?
I really enjoyed making films, and I realized that I could combine something that I really like doing along with something that needs to be, like, spoken about.
Jeffrey, tell me about your involvement with climate change in film.
So I actually, I happened to submit to the same film festival that Alexis submitted to. In 2017, I chose to do my topic on plastic bottles because my city government, we had an initiative where we wanted to have students in the schools in our district purchase less water bottles in order to cut down on plastic pollution. And I made the video for them, and I also saw this wonderful opportunity, so I decided to submit the film.
Yeah, great. We can hear a little clip from that right now.
35 billion bottles are thrown away annually. Consequently, 17 million barrels of oil are estimated to be used per year. I actually went to a recycling facility and took a short tour. That's me, the one wearing the bright yellow outfit, which frankly has much better taste than anything I've ever worn.
So tell me, both of you, when you look back on your life, when was the moment that you first became aware of climate change or global warming?
So about 2 years ago was when I really started to notice, and also becoming a lot more active in, like, the political area. I was mostly hearing about it on the news and, like, from my parents and them just talking about it a lot. And also with the election coming up, that was a big topic within it. And
I think I first became aware in seventh grade. I was new to my school because we just moved from Illinois. And there's this one teacher that I really liked. Her name was Miss Tyler. She taught English and history for us. And she knew that I was still a little shy, so she invited me to join her lunch club, which happened to be the green team or the environmental club in our middle school. And I remember really enjoying being with all these passionate people. And even though I hadn't really like cared about environmental science before, I started really caring after being in her club for middle school. But it wasn't really until high school that I started putting film together with environmentalism.
When did you make the connection that it could be impactful to do a film about climate change?
I just think film as a medium in general is one of the most effective ways to give a message across to a specific audience. You could always read about the topic or have someone talk to you about it, but there's no other, I guess, medium that quite shows it, like quite gives a message like film does. You have someone who's directly talking to you and you have visuals, and it could be edited in a way that really inspires you to do something about it. And I just think that's something that no other form can really do.
You can edit film in a way where like it's quick and catches the attention and keeps the attention of our generation. It's a creative way to kind of spread the word about this topic.
Yeah, I'm curious what you think, how your generation thinks about climate change compared to, say, an older generation, and what's the best way to teach somebody in high school or middle school about what's going on compared to maybe what you hear on the news, like what you showed in your film?
Yeah, definitely. I think our generation is definitely more exposed to it just because of social media, so that is another bonus, just because a lot more people are aware of it and realize that it's a real thing that's happening. And one of the biggest things is to make it more of a trend, and people like to hop on the trends.
We know that because of the climate crisis or climate change, there's a good chance that we will live worse lives than the generations before us. And we, of course, think it's extremely unfair because we weren't responsible for the decisions, some of the negative decisions that have impacted our climate. But then we also understand we will experience all the negative effects, and so are the generations that follow us. So I think the reason why we are so motivated or passionate about climate change is that right now, a lot of us are still kids, so we feel like we can't do anything about it, but we're still going to be affected by it. So we have to use our voices in whatever way we can. And a lot of the people I know, they're planning on going into maybe some form of environmental science as a job, but we just hope that it isn't too late to do something about it by the time we can.
How does it make you feel to kind of grow up in a world where all you hear is kind of doom and gloom in that sense, like you're saying?
It's pretty horrible, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's hard whenever you like listen to the radio and they talk about climate change, or you open an article, because you know that most of the news is going to be bad. So it kind of sometimes it like starts numbing you to be listening to all this news. Yeah. But you still have to move on and hope that you can do something in the future.
So what gives you hope in those moments of, you know, feeling really horrible about it, like you said?
Like, we'll figure out something to do. Like, each generation has their own crisis, and this is our crisis. And I'm sure we're going to figure out something to do. And even if like the effects aren't immediate, it hopefully we'll be able to like slow down the process enough where we have more time to do more research.
We just heard from Bay Area filmmakers Alexis Bugs Hodgson and Jeffrey Chen. They spoke with KALW's Angela Johnston. You can see their films at the San Francisco Green Film Festival. It begins today and it runs until Sunday. Find links to the films and more info about the festival at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. We're going to head to a different part of San Francisco now, one very close to KALW's heart, and to KALW itself. The Portola District is just down the hill from our station, in the southeast side of the city. It was officially designated as San Francisco's Garden District in 2016, and that's being celebrated, as you might have heard on KELW, this Saturday with the annual Portola Garden Tour. It's a walkabout of 25 neighborhood gardens. One of our reporters, Josiah Luis Alderete, wanted to get to know the Garden District for himself, so he found a tour guide of his own, an artist who created a mural telling the story of the neighborhood.
Arthur Koch and I are standing in front of his latest project, a giant mural in three panels showing the district's rich history.
The one common element across all of the three panels is the skyline of McLaren Park there. That's the unifying element there. And I look up from my backyard and that's what I see every day is the McLaren Park skyline.
The mural covers one of the outside walls of the grocery outlet over on Silver Street. It's a colorful mashup of the Portola's different cultural histories.
So then we have the people who were here first, the Olone Indians, and floating down Islas Creek, which has since been filled in. And then up on the hill.
It shows people who have lived in the neighborhood and some of the Portola's more distinct landmarks and architecture.
There's a whole block of greenhouses, and they used to grow roses and all different kinds of flowers that supplied San Francisco and Central California. And then after World War II, they changed those flower gardens to what they call victory gardens, which are vegetable gardens that supplied...
Arthur won a contest last year that was co-hosted by the Portola Neighborhood Association. He completed the mural in December 2016 with the help of many other residents.
Like 14 people volunteered to help me.
He also got to know his neighbors a lot better.
I met a lot of people that had grown up in this neighborhood that were second or third generation Portolans, you know, as well as, you know, new immigrants that barely spoke English. But they all really reacted positively, and if they didn't offer to help me, that some people would bring me refreshments or drinks.
It's part of a series of beautification projects happening in the area that's aimed at reclaiming the district's history.
The city recently officially named the Portola the Garden District because we were kind of like the farms for San Francisco a long time ago.
Listening to Arthur, it's clear that he's as much a local historian as he is an artist. I asked him to take me on a tour of the neighborhood and point out some of the people and places we see in his mural. As a light rain begins to fall, we cut through Grocery Outlet's front parking lot. Arthur begins to point out spots in the neighborhood that have come and gone since he moved back here in the 1990s.
You know, the Idalo Market is not there anymore. That's a wig store now.
What was the Idalo Market before?
It was an Italian supermarket, and they had their own butcher. As you see, they got the ducks and the hogs hanging in the window there. And, you know, the Jewish synagogue is no longer a synagogue, but it still has the Star of David there.
What is it now?
It's an evangelical church.
Many of the Italian and Jewish stores that used to be here are gone. Now, Chinese and Vietnamese businesses stand in their place. More than a third of the people living in the Portola today are Asian American.
22 years ago, it was really evenly mixed, I gotta say, you know. Blacks, whites, Latins, Chinese.
Now, a lot of the black and white people have moved out. Arthur points to an old restaurant to our left.
Well, Johnson's Barbecue has been closed for a while, and they're trying to find somebody to put a business in there, hopefully another barbecue place.
The Portola has changed, like so much of San Francisco, that it can be hard to see past the worn and comfortable-looking houses and storefronts in the neighborhood and find those layers of history that were created around here. Our tour is almost over. Arthur and I are walking past one of the Portola's more popular public spaces, Pelega Park. Almost immediately, Arthur is reminded of a story.
Sulagi Pelega. And there used to be a lot more Samoans in this neighborhood. And he was able to mediate between gang members to try to reduce gang violence. But unfortunately, in the process of doing that, he got shot and killed himself, so.
Pelega's story is one that many residents around here will always associate with the neighborhood, he says. We continue walking away from the playground and stop at the corner of San Bruno Avenue. Thank you so much for talking with me, Arthur.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
After saying goodbye to Arthur, I start making my way back to his mural for one last look. I can see how the portal's quiet streets might not necessarily reflect the culture and people that have passed through it the way other San Francisco neighborhoods do. This is still in my mind as I find myself in front of Arthur's mural again, where I see Maltese dancers next to Ohlone Indians, next to a Chinese man doing Tai Chi, surrounded by Italian immigrants working in Rainbow Gardens, while Jerry Garcia jams off in the distance. Suddenly, the notion of the Portola not having much of an identity dissipates into a thought that this quiet neighborhood is, in fact, lush with history and culture. In San Francisco's Garden District, I'm Josiah Luis Alderete for Cross Currents.
That story originally aired in 2017, 1 year after the Portola officially became San Francisco's Garden District. You can find out more information about the Portola Garden Tour, which happens this Saturday, by heading over to kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. Now let's turn to a different form of artistry. Brendan Chan's dancing shoes have touched classroom floors of his San Francisco schools, they've glided across cruise ships around the world, and they've hit national stages when he toured with the Bodyguard musical. Now he's back home in the city, performing in one of the most popular Broadway shows of all time, Hamilton. He plays George Eaker. Brendan sat down to talk with KALW's Janae Darden.
So when did you start dancing?
I was in fifth grade. There's a studio called Star Dance Studio in the Inner Sunset. My little sister was going there to take ballet and jazz at the time, and my mom had pretty much given up finding any sports activity for me, because all throughout elementary school and some of middle school, she's like, okay, Brendan's active. We need to put him in basketball. He doesn't like basketball. Put him in baseball. He doesn't like baseball. We're going to put him in soccer, in horseback riding, in roller hockey. And then first it was gymnastics in third grade, which I actually stuck with. And then fifth grade came around and she just said, there's a free boys tap class at Star Dance Studio where my little sister goes. And so I just went to it and I enjoyed it. And then I stuck with it for the next maybe 4 years or so. And during that time, I started taking jazz class, hip hop and breakdancing. And by the time I got to high school, it was all b-boy club and competition hip-hop at a different studio called Sunset Academy of Dance in the Sunset as well. So that became my life. All 4 years of high school is just competition hip-hop and breakdancing.
And so your parents, so they were accepting of you wanting to go into dance?
Yeah, I didn't realize how rare that was until I got to college. But not super common to pursue hip hop, you know, or just like for fun in high school. Like a lot of young Asians do that, especially if you look at like the K-pop culture. Everyone wants to learn choreography, you know, hip hop. But to pursue that professionally, you know, when I got to the dance department in UC Santa Barbara, look around, one, there's barely any guys, but there's also, you know, zero Asian guys too, you know. And then if thinking back, you know, they just, When college time came around, it's expected that I'll go to a college, as it was with my brother and was with my sister, and generally everyone of the first generation Asian race in San Francisco. But they just said, you know, pick the major you want to do, because they know my personality is such that if I don't want to do something or pursue it, I'm really not going to put that much effort into it. And the only thing I really enjoyed at the time was dance. So I just went straight for the dance department, which was a complete turnaround because it was ballet tights and, you know, contemporary modern, which was the opposite of what I was doing for, you know, 4 years.
Was that a struggle for you?
Oh, yeah. Tights are a struggle. Yeah. So are dance belts. And, yeah, it was basically 4 years of me trying to not be the hip-hop guy in a dance department that focuses on ballet and modern. And then every time I came home,
you know, I'm the ballet guy amongst my b-boy friends, you know, so we'd still practice and do hip-hop and breakdancing, but I was straddling two worlds, which is really funny. When I got to my first audition after college, I moved down to LA. Mm-hmm. We were being trained to be in dance companies, do company work, very much contemporary modern. And I knew that wasn't for me. I like entertainment more than anything else. So I went straight for cruise ship auditions and theme park auditions. And I thought, okay, I'm just going to use my entertainment skills. But, you know, lo and behold, what they want to see are kicks and turns and jumps and technical dance skills that I wouldn't have learned in hip-hop or breakdancing that I very much needed my education for. But really, everything I do is a mixture of the two. So first time in 2016, I moved to New York in the spring and, like, really put my skills to the test. And it is humbling. When I got to New York, I didn't want to dip into my savings from cruise ships. So I worked, you know, I waited tables, you know, at a sushi restaurant. I worked for a tour bus company, did catering, the whole shebang. It's kind of like the rite of passage for performers going to New York. But that was when, after about maybe 5 or 6 months of auditioning, I got my first tour, which is The Bodyguard.
How did Hamilton happen?
Funny thing is, it wasn't even necessarily after The Bodyguard. I did my first Hamilton audition before I even moved to New York in 2016. I was in LA finishing a tour with my old university dance company, and I was about to fly into New York for the first time. I'm in LA, and there is a hip-hop dancer call for Hamilton, and I thought, okay, I've heard of Hamilton. You know, my last cruise ship tour, everyone was talking about Hamilton. So I went to the audition. It was a lot of fun. It was, you know, all hip hop, which was very refreshing. But also the hardest part was that it wasn't about, you know, killing the choreography. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of LA dancers tend to, you know, think of, you know, you go to audition, you just have to slay it. You know what I mean? You have to be the biggest, brightest, coolest dancer with all the big tricks. And that was my mentality. And that was my first audition. I got cut after the second round. You know, you want to see more than just, you know, how flashy are you? Can you tell a story, right? So when I was in Minneapolis doing West Side Story, I got my final callback invite, and the plan was to fly in Friday morning, do the callback for an hour and a half, and then fly back and catch the evening performance of West Side, which was insane. But in the hour and a half, I did my final callback, dance for the choreographer Andy Blankenbuehler for the first time. So the first time they got to see me after me doing auditions for 2 years. So the following Monday, I got a call from my agents, and they said, "You booked Hamilton." It finally happened. I hear the cheer of the agents in the background. It was really, really fun. And then when he sent the contract, I said, okay, so let's see. It says it starts in San Francisco, going home. And it said it ends in San Francisco, like the 1 year, you know, essentially of the contract. And I just said, starts and ends in San Francisco. That's when I realized that this was a sit down, you know, in San Fran, as opposed to, I knew they said it was going to be the Ann Peggy tour. So I'm thinking, okay, time to go back out on tour, right? But I wasn't expecting to spend the entire year in San Francisco at home.
Why do people love this production so much? I mean, for you, you said it was a dream. So what is so special about Hamilton?
Yeah. What I find is that, well, when I first watched it, you know, I've been told about how great, you know, it is, a hip-hop show, it's all this rap, and I've heard a couple songs, and I saw the first time in Chicago. And after watching it, you know, the first thing I did was I took out my phone and Google, you know, and just went and, like, Googled Hamilton's life and Eliza Hamilton's life and Aaron Burr. And because these are all characters who are very, many ways, very well represented by the history, you know, on the book that Lynn based it off of, you know, by Ron Cherno, I became very invested in the story of it. And it really, you know, speaks to me with the way the music's written, you know, everything rap. I mean, I think, oh my gosh, this is how these people actually talked in the late 1700s. It's not, but right. Basically, but basically, you know, the story's all there. And I feel much more invested into the story because all of this happened. You know, that's one big thing for me, is that it takes a lot to create characters out of thin air and make a great story out of it. But when they're real, there's a much stronger sense of connection and emotion to it, because this is what happened, you know? And of course, you know, the medium of it being hip hop and multiculturalism, I mean, it's way more digestible for me too, you know? And I think that
very much an American musical in that way. It talks about our history, but it brings, you know, our diversity into play. You know, that is really groundbreaking to me.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is I got a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough. A shining piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power speaks.
That was dancer Brendan Chan speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. You could see Brendan perform in Hamilton at the Orpheum Theater in San Francisco. Find info at kalw.org. And if you're interested in staying up on the arts, you could find our coverage in one easy place, our e-newsletter. Sign up at our website and click Cross Currents. Show me where the ammunition is. Let's tune in now to a local band. This is New Normal from San Francisco. They're playing at El Rio in the city tomorrow night. Today's team includes Julia Linus Goodman, Precious Green, Sophie Codner, Lisa Morehouse, True Quinn, and Sarah Lai Sterland. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tarek Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager today is Kristen McCandless. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.